Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. We just returned from a very passionate debate at the Democrats of Red Rock Breakfast about the legalization of marijuana in Arizona. It's called Proposition 205. Mike and Gary are out today. My brother Chuck sitting over there. He's a close personal brother. And we'd like these gentlemen to introduce themselves and I guess tell us whether you're for or against it, and then we'll get into the debate about it. But just introduce who you are. So, Ed, if you just start, tell people who you are, what your background is, and then we'll go to Michael.
Okay. My name's Ed Gogek. I'm a psychiatrist. I've practiced over 20 years in Yavapai County in Prescott. I've got a subspecialty in substance abuse, and so I spent the past 30 years working with drug addicts and alcoholics, and I'm definitely against this. And the reason is, you know, I'm a very liberal Democrat. As I just said at this other meeting, I cast my first vote in my life for George McGovern. I just voted for Bernie Sanders. I'll be voting for Hillary. I've voted almost straight Democratic my whole life. I support almost every Democratic cause, usually on the liberal side, especially when it comes to income. But as a doctor who works with substance abusers, I see what drugs and especially marijuana do to people, and I'm very opposed to it. Also, as a teenager, I was a daily user, and I used pretty heavily for about 2 years, and that experience has also made me very opposed to marijuana because I know what it did to me, and I do not want that happening to other kids.
And we have Michael, who's been on the show several times. He's running for Congress. From what district, Michael?
I'm running from Congressional District 4. I'm Michael Weiser. In addition to being a Democratic nominee for Congress, I'm the state director of Normal. And in a previous organization, I had been one of the people that helped draft Prop 205. I'm very much in favor of it. I've been fighting the drug war since my childhood in the borderlands of Texas and Mexico. And for me, I'm looking forward to a time when our country is not dominated by a criminal element when it comes to cannabis.
And our third guest is...
Hi, my name is Adam Kinsey, and I am the campaign manager for the campaign to regulate marijuana like alcohol in Arizona. We are in support of Proposition 205.
All right, let's start with the debate. Tell us, let's start with Adam. Adam, tell us a little bit about what the main points of Proposition 205 are, and then we'll ask Ed, you know, we can ask Ed to respond to some of those. But tell us what the proposition is for folks out there who know there's a proposition. They know it consists of legalizing cannabis, but they don't know the details of what it would mean.
Right. So Proposition 205 will allow adults who are 21 years of age and older to possess and privately consume up to 1 ounce of marijuana. It establishes a 15% excise tax on retail marijuana sales, and that revenue from that will be allocated to public health and education. It creates a system of licensed businesses. It establishes the Department of Marijuana licenses, and they're going to control things like regulate things like cultivation, manufacturing, testing, labeling. And then it provides local governments with authority to regulate and limit marijuana businesses within their jurisdiction. And the four things we really talk about out on the campaign trail are safer communities, money for schools, the fact that regulation actually works, and the social justice impacts of Prop 205.
But Adam, how bad is marijuana for people? Because I think when I hear Ed talk, that's the core of what he's saying is that marijuana is so bad for people that legalization will make it more available. It's not like it's not available now, pretty much everywhere.
Yeah, and, you know, I grew up in the D.A.R.E. generation where we were taught in the sixth grade there's a hierarchy of things. And in that hierarchy, marijuana is much much more harmful to you and to society than alcohol. And what we're finding out now is that's just factually inaccurate. Marijuana is less toxic than alcohol. For instance, there has never been a death attributed to overdose of marijuana. There are 1,600 deaths annually to overdose of alcohol poisoning. And in chronic use, alcohol is far more harmful than marijuana. So when we say that it should be treated and regulated like alcohol, it's because it's safer than alcohol, and we think that's how we should be handling it.
Ed, do you want to respond to that? Because I think most of us know people who on the one hand, you know, smoke marijuana every day and function at a very high level and do analytical work. And if you're a certain age, you watch marijuana's negative effects on a lot of other people who lost all their drive, all their interest, and as far as I know, ended up smoking marijuana as their main human activity.
Okay, well, we've already talked about three things. I'd like to address them all. What's actually in this initiative, which I don't think we've heard, and the whole tax issue, and then let's go to that. The problem with this initiative, and it's the same thing that happened in Ohio, is that it creates a monopoly for current dispensary owners who, not coincidentally, are the people who are funding the entire initiative. The initiative will give them the first right to all the licenses. It will give them unlimited right to grow and sell, whereas anybody else who comes along can't. And it gives them the right to set up shop even when towns and cities vote against it. In Colorado, towns and cities can vote, no, we do not want retail sales. And any newcomer has to follow that, but this law specifically allows current dispensary owners. So it gives them not quite a monopoly, but it gives them a huge amount of market share, and it's written to do that. There's actually a group of marijuana users that, and you can see them on the Arizona Secretary of State's website, that is opposed to this, and it's because it's a money grab, and that is what's happened to the whole marijuana movement.
Let Ed respond to that point, and then we'll go back to you.
So the issue of monopoly is not quite accurate. So there are 99 medical licenses currently in Arizona, and the adult use licenses will number between 140 and 150. So we will have more folks than just the medical marijuana licenses. Also, the initiative allows for growth. What I mean by that is it ties the number of adult use dispensary licenses to the number of Series 12, I believe, liquor licenses. So at a 1-to-10 ratio. So as the number of Series 12 liquor license increases, so do the number of adult use provisions. And so I think it's disingenuous to say that it's a monopoly when clearly more folks, just than the 99 medical dispensaries, will be able to be operating.
Okay, Michael, you want to chime in? Get right on.
Yeah, I'd like to expand on that. When we talk about the number of licenses that Adam was referring to for recreational use, adult use, he's talking about the retail licenses. The word monopoly means mono, meaning single. The retail licenses are starting out at 162. That's 10% of the alcohol licenses that the formula is based on. However, retail is only one of the five types of business licenses that this program is going to be opening up. The idea, like I said, I was one of the activist organizers involved in the drafting of this, and we were trying to figure out how to take the pins out from underneath the illegal market, which dominates Arizona's marijuana. We have five different licenses, so a person can get a license to be a cultivator, either a small cultivator, or if they demonstrate skills within the industry, they can become an unlimited cultivator. There's also a license for manufacturing products, whether it be edibles, concentrates. There's a license for being a commodities broker and not being at either end but in the middle. There's a license for testing and then the retail licenses that Adams was referring to. So we have a potential for thousands of licenses being let to people in Arizona. We're hoping to create a small entrepreneurial opportunity, because that's the way that we take people from the illegal market and get them into a legal market.
Okay, Adam, that sounds like a fairly diverse bunch of people that Michael's talking about, a diverse way of approaching this business, doesn't it?
Let me just go over this. It will be an oligopoly mostly controlled by the current dispensary owners who paid for this, and I do not think that's an appropriate way to use the initiative process. Secondly, the taxes really are a myth. Governor Hickenlooper said, and he just said it last year, he said, this is Colorado's governor, he said, I tell other governors that we are not making any extra revenue from pot sales. Alcohol and tobacco are heavily taxed. They are a net drain on state budgets. Marijuana will be the same way. These folks said that marijuana is less harmful than alcohol. As an addiction specialist, I will tell you, we never tell anyone that one drug is more harmful or less harmful than the other because they're all worse in their own way. Marijuana is far worse at causing psychosis. It is the drug that causes people to drop out. It's been implicated in kids dropping out of school more than any other. And you know, alcohol itself is a lesson on why we wouldn't want to legalize another drug. And nobody is proposing that we legalize marijuana and make alcohol illegal. They're simply proposing adding it to the mix. And so I don't look at it as compared to alcohol. I look at it as what it's going to do to the kids growing up in this country.
Okay, Adam.
So Governor Hickenlooper has evolved a little bit on this issue. I think the first year the revenue wasn't quite where the projections had it, and I think since then he's changed it. Let me read you the more recent quote from Governor Hickenlooper. Now I look at how far we've come, and I think there's a real possibility that we'll have a system that works. If you eliminate the black market, you make it harder for kids to get marijuana. We can put that money into education for kids. The sky isn't falling. People thought it was the end of civilization as they know it, and it wasn't. That's Governor Hickenlooper now, and he was one of the staunchest opponents to the Colorado legalization effort. So I think even those that were vehemently opposed to it have sort of come to light now and are changing their tune a little bit. So I think regulation does in fact work.
Let me just say that Denver has gotten no money for its schools, and the superintendent there said all we are getting for marijuana legalization is more marijuana. There will not be any tax benefit from this.
Denver is the number one city for new businesses, rated by Forbes magazine. They have the state of Colorado is number 8 in unemployment. Arizona is 45th. The number one new place for developing a new business is in the state of Colorado. If you look at the most recent Forbes statistics, Denver and Colorado are seeing a huge uptick. And I'm not saying that's directly and absolutely responsible only because of marijuana, but I think it is not the hellscape that I think the prohibitionists and our opponents would like us to believe it is.
Actually, the Denver Visitors Bureau just released a report, and it was scathing because it said that Denver is losing convention business because there is so much panhandling and homelessness and public drug use downtown, and it's all because of legalizing marijuana.
Part of the fun of this. I lived in New York for 30 years, and the amount of panhandling and the amount of homeless people is not related really to drug usage or not banning or, you know, it's based on public policy toward those folks. And we had a tremendous panhandling and public begging problem in New York, and all these drugs were illegal, and they had draconian policies putting people in jail for life for repeat offenses.
You know,
I just don't believe that's true.
It is. I've worked in homeless clinics. I work in the jail. And I ask my patients, where do you get the money for drugs? And because these are people who don't have a job. And the number one answer is they say, I fly a sign. I panhandle. Panhandling is very much the way that really down and out drug users get their money.
Michael?
Part of the fun of talking with Dr. Goick is we often have competing statistics about the same kind of topic. Two statistics I'd like to throw in is that Colorado is reporting that their homeless population is declining, not increasing. And also, Colorado is rated number one for tourism right now, and it has the strongest growing economy, like Adam referenced. These are things that aren't in keeping with the scare stories that we're hearing from the prohibitionists. I mean, if you summarize the message that we get, it's back to the 1937 Reefer Madness.
Chuck?
Yes, this is Chuck Williamson, Steve's brother, and I came to the debate this morning uncertain as to how to vote. I did vote in favor of the medical marijuana, but I was almost certain to vote against this liberalization because I couldn't see the advantage. Frankly, I'm skeptical of the whole economic issue because I suspect what our state legislature will do is what they did with other funding initiative measures is ignore them and have to be sued for a decade in order to actually generate the money. So to me, it's more of an issue of whether it is harmful. And I think in a debate, it came to the issue of whether there was agreement it was harmful for younger people that may permanently damage themselves. So to me, one of the core issues is how do you prevent a dispensary environment from increasing the number of young people who can be damaged while their brains are still developing?
Let's start with Adam here. And
The first thing is you're absolutely right to be skeptical of the legislature sweeping funds because that's how they roll. That's what they do. They're very good at it. But this initiative does, which is particularly clever, is it absolutely locks up these funds. The legislature can't sweep them. It also prevents the legislature from bait and switching. So the JLBC says that it's going to be $123 million a year coming into Arizona, and $55 million of that's going to be going to K-12 directly. What the initiative says is the legislature is prevented from underfunding K-12 by that amount and replacing it with the marijuana taxes. And that's how it goes for the DHS money as well. So the legislature cannot pull money away, give it away for whatever they want to, and then replace those monies with marijuana. So that's the first issue there. But I understand your skepticism because we've seen this legislature sweep funds before. The issue with young people, though, is a great one. There are a couple of things I'd like to say about this. The reports out of Colorado, the most recent survey was their Healthy Kids survey they do every year, and it indicated that the marijuana use among teenagers has not gone up from the time before legalization to after. So that uptick has not occurred. So we're not seeing more access to marijuana with legalized marijuana. And the second issue is part of the funds, most of the funds from the excise tax are going to go to K-12 funding, which Lord knows they need. But part of the funds go to the DHS, and part of their charge is going to be public information campaigns. And I think that's something that we really need that explains the relative harms of marijuana, of alcohol, of tobacco. And I think those advertisements should be geared towards children to let them know this is adults are allowed to use this, you are not. Same with alcohol, same with tobacco. And explain to them why they shouldn't use it, that it hurts your brain, your brain development, whether we're talking about alcohol or marijuana. I think we've seen some PSAs in the past. I remember the tobacco PSAs when I was growing up were particularly effective. I'd love to see something like that marketed, geared towards children, talking to them about the harms of alcohol and marijuana. And the beautiful part of this initiative is 20% of that excise tax revenue goes to DHS, and they can do just that.
On the question of harms, we know that marijuana is very harmful to the developing teenage brain. Teenagers who use marijuana have lifelong effects, and this has been studied a huge amount. Teenagers who use marijuana heavily have lower IQ. Even the moderate users are more likely to drop out, more likely to not finish college. They earn less as adults. They're more likely to be unemployed. And the major medical groups that deal with children and teenagers, the College of Pediatricians, the Academy of Pediatrics, the Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, and, of course, the addiction doctors that I belong to, are all absolutely against legalization, and it is based on the science. We don't say, Adam's giving the idea that, we should legalize it and then educate the kids. What the medical groups do based on the science is say, no, that is not the way to prevent it. The way to prevent teenage use is to keep it strictly illegal. And I've got to say, that is what the science is saying.
But it's never prevented teenage use. In fact, it makes marijuana cool because it is illegal.
Absolutely.
Because it is a secretive thing. It makes it cool. I know it can't balance the legal and illegal, but it seems to me there's a lot of encouragement of marijuana use by making it illegal. And the other thing is it hasn't stopped marijuana use.
Okay, all this is wrong. And I'm going to tell you, in 1978, we had the highest rate of teenage marijuana use that this country has ever had. And the parent movement formed. It was groups of parents who put pressure on the news and entertainment media to stop promoting ideas like this and to stop glamorizing the drug. And over the next 14 years, teenage daily use dropped by 80%. what you're saying, that they're going to use no matter what, is absolutely untrue. We know how to prevent almost all teenage marijuana use. And it's a myth that they're going to use no matter what.
You're creating a whole class of people who are engaging in illegal substance use, who are then afraid of the police, afraid of reporting crime to the police. Aren't you creating more problems making it illegal than would occur if it was legal?
He's talking. Listen, he's saying your arguments. I'm going to respond to them.
I'm not saying his arguments.
Not at all.
My argument.
But they're the same ones.
Don't
do it that way.
Well, but it is. You can't say that it's
Ed. It's an argument. Respond to the argument.
What I'm saying is we can prevent almost all teenage use, and so we are not creating a bunch of people who are criminals. What we do when we keep it strictly illegal, today we are not horribly criminalizing it. We are putting people into treatment when they are arrested. So what you do by keeping it strictly illegal is you prevent a whole generation of teenage marijuana users.
Let's let Michael respond.
A whole generation is probably a good number to use, because since 1965, we've had 20 million people arrested in America for cannabis charges. Now, I'm not going to say that all those people go to jail. In fact, you don't have to go to jail to have a day with a cop ruin your life. When people get arrested for cannabis, especially in the state of Arizona, immediately they get charged with a felony. It's up to the prosecutor. It's up to the policeman if they want to file that as a misdemeanor or not. But the law says it's a felony. So everybody who gets arrested for cannabis, even if they never set a day in prison, their economic earning power is damaged in the future. They're kicked to a side out of the mainstream of society. And they can't get student loans. They can't get school aid. There's all these different things get taken away from somebody because we want to make sure that they're punished enough to where somebody else doesn't reach into the cookie jar. From our childhood, it's a matter of how you deal with your kid trying to get into the cookie jar.
Well, I guess my question is, there must be some range between lock them up and everybody's on their own. I'm not a libertarian. In fact, I'm very much anti a libertarian. So I would say, what's our current situation? What is the alternative for some juvenile found using marijuana? What happens to them?
And there actually is. There's a middle way, and the best example is Sweden. Sweden has some of the strictest drug and marijuana laws in the world. It's absolutely strictly illegal there, but they do huge amounts of education, lots of prevention. When they arrest people, they put them into treatment. And what they have in Sweden, they are closing prisons. They have one of the lowest rates of traffic fatalities. They have by far a lower rate of teenage use.
Portugal
did not legalize. No.
They decriminalized.
It did not legalize.
Decriminalized drugs, and they've seen, as far as I understand, a reduction in drug use.
Portugal works like a huge drug court, so they do very much the same thing. You can still get arrested for drug possession, but instead of threatening you with jail, you have to go before a commission that's made of a psychiatrist, a psychologist, and a lawyer who can impose all sorts of sanctions if you don't cooperate with treatment. It's the same thing that I would like. I would love to see us do that here. It gets people into treatment. My aim is to get people clean and sober because they are happier clean and sober.
Michael, what's your thought on that?
Well, I think that it's kind of interesting to have somebody establish what is acceptable and what is acceptable chemical use. We're all consuming different things every day. Sometimes he's drinking coffee, and should we make coffee illegal? Should we make aspirin illegal? What are our standards to determine what's going to be legal or not? It's obviously not on harm. Because if it was on harm, we wouldn't have so many people drinking, we wouldn't have so many people smoking, we wouldn't have video games all over the place. There's lots of things that cause harm. So it becomes a matter of a personal preference and then imposing that will on other people.
But aren't driven sort of by feeling miserable and unhappy? I mean, if you're feeling really good, why would you use any of these substances?
Well, so Dr. Jeffrey Singer is a big supporter of ours. He's a fairly well-known physician in Arizona. And, he'll talk about how Sometimes he'll go home and unwind after a day of surgery with a glass of scotch. Some days he will go home after a day of surgery and smoke a joint. And his point is, as a free American, as somebody is who is not doing harm, someone who's not addicted to either substance, what is the harm in him doing that? And I think that may be a little bit of a disconnect that we have with Ed and the folks who are opposed to this. The mere fact that you are consuming marijuana does not make you a drug addict, does not make you a slave to that drug. If I go home and have a beer tonight, I am not an alcoholic. So I think that there is a great time and a place for abuse specialists in treatment, but I'm not sure the person who smokes a joint once in a while or who has a glass of scotch once in a while is abusing the drug, because that's what they choose to do to unwind.
Now, I'll tell you, if a patient of mine told me that they had to use something to unwind every night,
it's not a drug, I would use a choice.
No, it's not a choice. I would say they have a problem. The other thing about marijuana is that marijuana has a very long-term effect. And there's this great study of airline pilots. This was done back in the 80s, where they smoked one joint. 24 hours later, they tested them on flying, and they could not land a plane safely. And anecdotal evidence does not trump. Yes, there are people who violate all these sorts of rules, but I'm saying overall, on this study, they could not fly a plane safely, and they all thought that they
were
doing fine.
You have a more recent study than 1980s. You're talking about a study that's
also. I would call this science denial. It's still good science.
Now this is interesting, though. I think we just touched on something.
Yeah,
I'm curious if Ed misspoke or if I misheard, but when I said somebody who wants to go home and have a glass of wine to unwind, or on a different day wants to go home and have a marijuana cigarette to unwind, you said that person is an addict?
No, what I said is if a patient told me that they had to use something every night to unwind, I would say, you are starting to develop a problem.
What if they choose to unwind?
People don't choose. This choose to unwind thing is a myth, because it's not, people don't unwind that way. Substances actually, they've shown this with tobacco. People always say, oh, tobacco relaxes me. And they've done so many studies on this, and what they've shown is when people are smoking, they are much more anxious and much more tense, and they feel much better when they actually quit. And it is the same with other drugs. So if somebody tells me, oh, I just use it to unwind, it starts to sound like denial to me. I want to go back to one other thing. I want to quote something from the LA Times, because you said this whole thing about people in jail. And the Los Angeles Times said this. They said, it is pure bunk.
Wait,
that
that's not what I said.
Jail space are wasted corralling and incarcerated marijuana users. It's not happening. It was decades ago, but today it's a myth. No one gets busted and jailed for merely smoking a joint. That is not happening.
That's not
really what Michael said. I know Michael's going to say he didn't say that. Michael's saying that there's a lot of harms, even if you're not jailed after the first use of marijuana. Also, a lot of people who use marijuana, seems to me they sell small amounts. Chuck?
Well, I just have to say, I don't understand what the Arizona law is. Is there a differing amount of marijuana that you possess that it becomes a felony?
Any amount is a felony
in Arizona.
Lots of things that are felonies in Arizona that are not necessarily felonies in other places.
What that means is if you're arrested for having a single cigarette of marijuana, then you have to negotiate it down. That is, you have to plead guilty to a lesser charge or so on. It gives power to the state.
Prosecutors, which is another issue we should talk about, because the number of court cases where you actually go to trial has been declining radically because prosecutors have this power to decide. So there's an article in the New York Times, somebody is selling 8 OxyContin in a rural county in Indiana, ends up with 15 years. Somebody doing the same thing in, San Francisco gets put in a rehab program. So there's tremendous variation across the country in what the response is. And not a lot, so the control of the prosecutor. So you are handling, I think, and Ed will probably disagree with me, a lot of power to prosecution for things. And when in the 60s, they used marijuana prosecution to intimidate people who opposed the war in Vietnam, who were for civil rights. I mean, it's not that it doesn't have a sort of nasty history to it.
Right. And what I want to say is don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And it is, you know, I'm definitely against abusive prosecution and a lot of other things that happen that I consider bad. But drug laws themselves get a lot of people into treatment. I work in a treatment program. A huge number of people come in because they got arrested. And a huge number of people are sent by the courts because they got arrested. As one, I had a patient, he said to me, I didn't get arrested. I got rescued. And the other thing is, I also agree that nobody, you know, these arrests that are happening are almost all happening when somebody is searched after they've been arrested for something else. The police are not out looking for marijuana. They're not prosecuting people for the marijuana. So the marijuana is pretty much an incidental. We are not filling jails and prisons with marijuana users.
Is that true, Michael, you think?
In the state of Arizona, there are 86 people that are serving prison time for marijuana. But again, this is, I'm trying to think of a polite way to say he's taking my words and make them sound like something I didn't
so
say.
So what did he do that, if he did that, well, how did he do it? What did you say?
That I said that there were people who get arrested, and he said I'm talking about people in jail. And those are greatly different things. Getting arrested, you have that mark on your record forever. You can't get academic loans. You can't. It affects your selective service. It affects your welfare benefits. It typically, when somebody has a arrest on their record, it lowers their earning power and takes them out of a positive section of society. So when we arrest people to try to, like, solve a problem, we actually create a different problem of socioeconomic poverty.
So let's let Ed talk about
it. I totally agree that having an arrest record for the rest of your life harms people, and it's a bad idea. I don't even like the fact that they can, you know, when you apply for a job, they can ask you about past drug use more than 5 or 10 years ago. I've had that experience as a teenage marijuana user 40 years later. If I say yes when I apply for a prison job, I could be denied the job. But the cure for that is not to throw out everything. The cure for that is what's called expungement. And New Jersey does it really well. If you get a drug charge, after several years clean and sober, you can apply to have it expunged. It's erased. And then after that, when they ask, have you ever been arrested, you can say, no, I have not. And what I like about that is we want people to get clean and sober because it makes them happy and it makes them more productive. And we want them to be first-class citizens. If somebody's gotten clean and sober and really turned their life around, I want them to be able to say no to that and never be judged.
Let me ask you a factual question. All three of you, or one of you, maybe you all agree on this. How much marijuana use is there in Arizona? I mean, do we have any idea how many people use marijuana? Do we have any idea to what extent? Do we have any idea how much money is flowing to the cartels from marijuana use?
So the federal government keeps tabs on usage rates, and it's by and large, it's a guesstimation game. Obviously, you can't go and ask people, hey, are you consuming an illegal substance right now? Have you in the last 30 days? It's not all that accurate. You know, even anonymous survey folks will be a little paranoid and not necessarily answer truthfully. That having been said, the rates that they have seen in Arizona is what the JLBC used to determine how much revenue we could expect in Arizona. Colorado has a slightly higher usage rate, but about the same population. And I'll tell you that last year there was $1 billion worth of legal marijuana sold in Colorado. So I think it's not a perfect comparison, but I think it would be true to say that there is at least $1 billion worth of illegal marijuana in the criminal market here in Arizona.
But what's your guess? We have 10 people. How many of them use marijuana? Probably, if the number of people who used it at one time is probably, you know, 10.
It depends on if they're at a Bush rally or at a Rastafarian concert.
Yeah, if 10, it's about 1. About 1 in 10 are current users, which is defined as having used over the past month.
And about 4 have used in their lifetime. Would you say that's about right?
It's about 4 in your lifetime. But, you know, it's the same thing with cigarettes. We should never look at lifetime use. We should be looking at current use. Because with cigarettes, the problem is not lifetime use, it's current use. But the big problem is that of the people who are using now, about a third of them are daily users. And those people, you know, that's where all the money comes from, the marijuana industry. But those are the people who have the most serious problem.
What? Let me ask you, and I maybe Chuck has a question here, but I'm a little baffled. I mean, suppose we all agreed that in an ideal world, nobody would play silly video games, nobody would smoke cigarettes, nobody would drink alcohol, nobody would use any kind of drugs other than prescribed by their doctor for a specific ailment. suppose we agreed that would be the ideal world. How do we deal with the fact that we don't have an ideal world where people do use drugs? And if it's 1 out of 10 or 4 out of 10?
Well, and that's one of the things when we talk about making communities safer. We acknowledge, and I think most folks would agree, that the war on drugs has been an abject failure. Prohibition has absolutely failed. So what we want to do is we want to turn that criminal market that exists and acknowledge that it exists and turn it into something that's healthier, more regulated, and that brings some ancillary benefits to the state. It's not – this issue and this campaign, this proposition is not about yes, I like marijuana, or no, I don't like marijuana, or those who consume it. It's not yes to marijuana or no to marijuana. It's how we marijuana. And are we going to take our heads out of the sand collectively as a state and acknowledge that this is something that's happening? It's a $1 billion criminal enterprise. And are we going to regulate it so we can make it a little bit safer for Arizona?
I disagree on all three points there. Let me just say, on the question of prohibition of drugs, it absolutely does work. And the stronger the prohibition, the better. When they ask teenagers what are the easiest drugs to get a hold of, it's always alcohol and tobacco. What are the hardest ones to get a hold of? It's going to be heroin and meth, because those are the ones that are most strictly regulated.
Somebody come back, Ed, and say to you, well, what about prohibition of alcohol? That was a disaster for the United States.
No, it was not a disaster.
Oh, you like that?
No, I don't like it. And I'll tell you why I don't like it, because alcohol is a weird drug with a social use. But during prohibition of alcohol, disorderly conduct dropped in half. Cirrhosis of the liver dropped by 2/3. The sort of petty crimes that fill jails and prisons actually decrease. But let me go back to this about community
so
safer.
So you would reinstitute prohibition?
No, absolutely not.
If it works so well, why not put it back in?
You're being really sarcastic with me. Now, let me say this.
I am being sarcastic because that seems like a...
No, that is not what I said.
That seems like a silly idea.
As the interviewer, you shouldn't be doing this. They can do that, but you can't. The problem with prohibition is that alcohol is this weird drug where there is widespread social use and widespread abuse. And I will tell you, if everybody who drank only to get drunk, we would still have prohibition. And that's my problem with marijuana, because everybody who smokes marijuana smokes to get stoned. There is no such thing as social use of marijuana where people smoke for the taste.
Well, this guy hasn't smoked in this century, according to his records, and he's trying to tell us what the social values are. I want to first address your question. I came to the $1 billion figure in a slightly different way. Right now, the medical marijuana program in 2015 grossed $215 million. And estimates are that only 3 out of 10 medical marijuana patients actually shop in dispensaries. So among the people who are cardholders, we're already looking at a $1 billion industry. That said, I wanted to challenge one of the things that you asked us to be ready to agree to. So what if we had an ideal world where nobody did this and nobody did that? And I'm not going to say that that's an ideal world. I'm going to ask why we're going to say that somebody gets to decide what the individual micro rights are of a person. And when we talk about drugs, you know, the number one substance of abuse on the planet is sugar. The World Health Organization is complaining about the addicts of sugar all around the planet, but we're not really looking at are we going to take that away? Why? Because it's part of what has become our culture, our society. People have the need to escape their unpleasantry. That is part of human biology going back to caveman days.
Let me ask, just try to shift the ground a little bit. What is convincing you that the legalization of marijuana will break the cartels' economic investment, that it'll break and weaken the vast amount of illegal marijuana sales?
But depending on who you ask, the cartels' cash crop is about 75% of their business. That's what they bring over the border. And as soon as states started legalizing, there was a great story in the Washington Post about this a few years ago. Mexican drug farmers were pleading to the states in Arizona to stop regulating marijuana because it's killing our business. And you can't just replace a field of marijuana plants with a field of poppies. That's not how agriculture works. You also can't replace the demand for marijuana with a demand for opiates, something like heroin. So what we see is we see American businesses within the state. So Arizona would be Arizona-grown business. That's where all the marijuana is purchased. So you don't have the if you don't have the demand for the number one cash crop, you're not going to have the supply issue. So you're going to see them shrink down a little bit. And the other on the demand side. On the retail shops, you're going to see folks going to the retail shop rather than the corner drug dealer because they want to buy with some confidence, with some peace of mind. They want a tested, regulated product. They want good labeling on their package so they know exactly what they're consuming, how much CBD versus how much THC, things of that nature. And those are the types of questions you can find out from your regulated legal dispensary that the corner drug dealer isn't going to have. So that's why in Colorado last year, we saw $1 billion worth of legal marijuana, and they've got a 25% excise tax. We only have a 15% excise tax on ours, and what we're seeing is the consumers are absolutely willing to pay it. So it's the nightmare scenario for drug cartels and drug pushers, which is one of the many reasons we say that Prop 205 leads to safer communities.
Let's go to Michael and then to Ed.
I got three different points that back up what Adam was just pointing out. One, the Colorado underground market is said to be cut by 60%. Two, the prices on legal cannabis in the state have dropped, and that has caused the prices on the street to drop comparatively. And then three, as Adams referred to, the marijuana growers in Mexico have seen a dramatic reduction in their cost for wholesale marijuana, which they sell in the United States. It was at $400 a pound, which is what it was when I was buying marijuana back in the 1970s, and now it's down to $25 a pound, which is, think of how big of an impact that has. People, like, don't substitute cannabis or other things for cannabis, because cannabis actually is something that's used to substitute for opioid addiction.
So let's Ed answer that, and then we're running out of time, and we've got about 3 minutes, and give you each a minute to sort of sum up your positions.
Okay, let me just say, what's happening is the cartels are actually moving to Colorado, and what they're finding is a lot of illegal grows in Colorado, and they're doing tax evasion. And the joke in Colorado is only tourists buy from the stores. Everybody else avoids the tax. So the black market is still there. The cartels are still there. This is going to sound really idealistic, but there were no drug cartels in the 1940s and 50s, and that's because people were not using illegal drugs. And I work with substance abusers. I see people who say they could never, ever quit. I see them become clean and sober and happy, and we know how to decrease and mostly eliminate substance abuse, and we should be doing that because that is what's best for people, and it's also what's best for the country overall.
So we're out of we're 2-1, so we're going to let Ed have the last word. So Adam, and then Michael, and then Ed, and we'll sum up the show.
That sounds fair to me. I would encourage folks out there listening to visit regulatemarijuana.org and also take a look at who is supporting the opposition. A $500,000 contribution just came in from one of the most notorious actors in the big pharma industry that push an opiate that is far more deadly and far more harmful to Arizona families than marijuana is, yet the opposition has no problem taking their money. And that's one of the largest contributions opposing marijuana in the history of the movement. So I encourage folks to visit regulatemarijuana.org and vote for safer communities and money for schools, and that's yes on 205.
Michael, we're running out of time.
I'm going to flog two websites. One is our state chapter, Normal, ArizonaNormal.org, and the national chapter, Normal.org. And then I want to ask people to keep in mind, cannabis rights are civil rights. If we want to have a country that is predicated on a police state, then we're going to keep prohibition. Cannabis has the opportunity to take away this police state. It has an opportunity to have a whole industry stop being criminal. And that is so incredibly important. I can't think of something else to talk
about. Okay, Ed. Let me just make an announcement, then we'll let you finish up. And that's the... this program and all our other programs will be available on the internet on BBID about 2 days after broadcast. Ed, you've got the last word.
Okay, yeah, I've written a book, Making the Case Against Legalization. You can find it at my website, marijuanadebunked.com. I do want to say that Sweden is not a police state, and they are my model for the way that we should be doing this. The medical community is absolutely adamant that legalization is a bad idea, and it would be harmful for teenagers. And what I want to say is we should stop looking at these laws through the ideas of drug users who consider it unfair. Start looking at it through the ideas of parents and teachers who want drug-free kids.
Thank you for being with us, folks. I hope you've enjoyed the debate here, passionate and conflict-ridden as it was. I think a lot of good points were made, and it gives you some basis to research these websites and check on the information that you've heard here from various different sources. You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.